You know, we are about to start a new series. We began with a very important series with the triple transformation. And we are halfway in that series. We finished two chapters in that series. The third chapter we are reading yourself. And the fourth chapter there, we shall do little later when you have finished the third chapter. So in the meantime, it was suggested that we can have another plunge into the life divine from another side. Life divine is like a huge palace. In it there are so many halls and rooms and balconies and towers and corridors of various kinds and the sub-corridors. And if you start somewhere, you can go on and on and on and see the whole palace by entering into any part of the palace. All of them are interconnected. But you can also enter from one side, go up to a certain point and again come out and go into another corridor and enter into another big hall. So this is another kind of a gallery through which we are entering into a huge hall with a tremendous dome. This consists of four chapters. Chapter number 9, 10, 11, 12. And before we launch upon this big voyage into these four chapters, let me explain the background of these four chapters. The life divine as a whole is regarded as the greatest philosophical book of our times. So when you call it a philosophical book, we must understand why it is called philosophical. It is not a book of yoga, such as the synthesis of yoga. It is not a book of poetry like Savitri is. It is not a scientific book, such as you find a book on physics or chemistry or biology. It is not a book of mathematics. So we must know what exactly is the meaning of philosophy. And having known that meaning, we can apply it to this book and say this is a philosophical book. What is philosophy? You might say that philosophy is an intellectual pursuit. Good morning. You are all right now? Yeah? Why don't you come here? You'll be more comfortable here. Philosophy is basically an intellectual pursuit. But so is science, so is mathematics. But while science, mathematics are also intellectual, philosophy is intellectual in a very specific manner. Its mode of intellectuality is somewhat different from the mode of intellectuality that you find in science or mathematics. All sciences ask one basic question. What is the nature of the object that is before us? All sciences ask this question. What is the nature of the object that is before us? And very often, in answering this question, two more questions are raised. Why is that object what it is? And how has that object become what it is? So what is the nature of the object? How is that object come about? And why has it come about? These three questions are raised by every science. Secondly, every science normally limits itself to one kind of object. Physics, for example, concentrates only upon all objects which are material in character. Biology is a science, but it concentrates upon all life organisms. Psychology is a science, but it concentrates upon only those objects which are mental in character. So the study of material objects and nature of matter is the study of physics. Study of life forms, organisms, is the subject matter of biology. The study of mind is the subject matter of psychology. And all the sciences ask these three questions. Physics asks the question, what is the nature of matter? Why is the nature of matter what it is? And how has matter come into being? These three questions are asked by physics. Similarly, biology asks this question, what is life organism? How is life different from matter? How is life different from mind? How has life come into existence? And why has it come into existence? And similarly, psychology asks the same questions in regard to the mind. Now, a question may be asked, can there be a science which does not limit itself only to one kind of object? Can there be a science which deals with three questions at the same time? What is matter? What is life? What is mind? Is there a science which asks the question, why at all are there matter, life and mind? A science which asks the question, how is it that matter, life and mind have come to be what they are? Now, there is nothing impossible in having such a science. There can be such a science. Up till now in the history of thought, such a science has yet not come into existence. Such a science has come to existence, but it is not intellectual science. For example, there is what you may call yoga, which is also a science. And which raises a question which is comprehensive. What is matter? What is life? What is mind? How are they related to each other? Why are they what they are? How are they what they are? Not only that, they ask the question about everything that is in existence, not only matter, life and mind. It also raises the question as to what else is there apart from matter, life and mind. But this science, which has developed right from the time of the Veda to the present day, is not intellectual in character. So as far as the intellectual history of the world is concerned, sciences so far have limited themselves, each one of them, only to one category of existence. It does not mean in the future that there cannot be a full science covering all the data of existence. There can be such a science in the future. But there is one difficulty in conceiving such a science. If the method is to be intellectual, then intellect should be capable of knowing all the facts of the universe at once. Look, as it were, in one vision. So if intellect is capable of arriving at the knowledge of all the data of the universe, then such a science becomes possible. But so far, it has been found that intellect is not capable of arriving at that vast vision. Intellect is by nature piecemeal. It takes one subject into hand, can deal with it properly, then it takes up another subject, can deal with it properly, can take up a third subject and take it up properly. But when it tries to correlate all the three, intellect finds it very difficult. Certain data which are necessary for taking the complete view of things, those data escape the grasp of the intellect. Or it is still found that those data require a long time to be collected so that we can have the total vision of all things. So in the future, there could be one day when all the data of the universe could be made to assemble together, and we could have one intellectual science of all the domains of existence. Such can be a future program, but so far such a thing has not happened. In the meantime, however, if you really want to know, even before this inquiry is over or can be undertaken, if you want to know intellectually the totality, can it be known? This is the question. In the meantime, even before you can collect all the data of the universe, without collecting all the data, is it possible to deal with all the data? It's a very difficult question because you are not in possession of all the data. And yet you want to develop a science of all the data without collecting all the data. Is such an endeavor possible? It is here that philosophy comes into the picture. Philosophy is a study of all the available data, not all the data, but of all the available data belonging to all the present sciences. And apply to the available data such an instrument that can give you the answers, intellectual answers, as to what can be imagined about all the data. You take all the available data, think about all these data together, and then imagine what all the data could be like. So you might say that philosophy is a kind of an exercise in imagination. It is somewhat like poetry. Poetry also is a subject of imagination. From a few data which are presented to the mind, poetry imagines and arrives at a perception. Art is also a matter of imagination. Music also is a matter of imagination. Now, philosophy is also a matter of imagination. But there is a difference between other imaginations and the imagination that is in philosophy. In the other domains of art, music, poetry, you are allowed to have fancy. Not only imagination, but also a fancy, even a fantasy. But in philosophy, while imagination is allowed, the imagination is not allowed to be fanciful. It is not allowed to be a fantasy. It is not allowed to be fictitious. Fiction, fantasy are not allowed. Then what kind of imagination is allowed? A rigorous imagination. There is in philosophy a rigor. Now this rigor consists of the notion of necessity. What is the nature of necessity in philosophy? Let me explain this concept of necessity. When I imagine that the moon is like the face of my mother, I am not required to prove it necessarily that the face of the moon is like the face of my mother. It may not be so, but to my experience, I feel it to be so. I don't need to prove to the others, look, it is necessarily so. It's a matter of imagination, matter of my personal experience. When I am in the upper hemisphere of the earth, when there is total darkness, and I am walking in that wilderness in the upper hemisphere, my experience is that wherever I turn, there is darkness. So I would say, all this is dark. Then I may even go forward and say, in imagination, that even though I have not walked all the paths of this upper hemisphere, I believe that everything is dark. And although I might not even know what is happening in the southern hemisphere, where there may be daylight, but to my experience, it may seem that everywhere there must be dark, as much dark as it is here in my experience. So I might even announce, everything is dark. All over is dark. In poetry, if therefore a poet says, all is dark, he will not demand from the poet a proof. Prove that everywhere, wherever you are not gone, it must be darkness. There must necessarily be darkness. You don't ask the poet to prove this question. In poetry, you allow this kind of imagination which is true to your personal subjective experience. Where even what you think is probable is allowed to be said as if it is true. But in philosophy, if you make a statement by imagination, you must be in a position to say that that imagination necessarily follows from all the data that are available to you. That is to say, you are able to imagine about other data which are not before you on the basis of the data which are available to you, but your intellectual argument must be such that would necessarily show that the other data which are not seen by you, not experienced by anybody so far, must be like this. You must have read some of the detective stories in which this kind of method very often is found to be very useful and very much applicable. Theft has taken place in a house and you don't know who has been the thief. Now there could have been many alternative answers to this question. On the basis of the data which are available, where you find that the whole house is actually intact. Even the door is locked, almirahs are locked, everything is in perfect order. Only in one small box, you have the most precious jewel, which is missing. Therefore, the question that is put before you is only this, who could have stolen this jewel? Now, the data are that the house is intact. All the almirahs are locked, perfectly locked. The rooms are locked. All the members of the family have gone out. So naturally you have two, three probable answers to this question. That before all the members of the family set out, one of the members who had access to the keys had very quietly taken out the jewel, and it is safely deposited elsewhere. So that now even if you search everybody, nobody can be found to be guilty. That is one possibility. The second is that during their absence, somebody who has got duplicate keys made in advance, who knows your program of going out, who knows exactly where the jewel lies, and by opening the duplicate keys very safely and very without disturbing anything else, gone straight to the jewel, taken out. So this is a second alternative. Or there could be another also, which you can imagine. Now out of two or three alternatives, all of them are probable, all of them are imaginations, because all of them are likely. Until you come to what is called a crucial fact, you will not be able to decide what necessarily must have happened. Usually the detectives, they have one task of finding out such facts which will necessarily prove that this alone must have happened and not anything else. Now similar is a method in philosophical reasoning. In the imagination that is allowed in philosophy, you have to rigorously follow a process in which the data which are available, from among those data you have to find some such data which will conclusively and necessarily show that other data which are not known must be of that nature. This is the law of necessity in philosophical reasoning. So philosophy arises at a time when certain data are available, and certain data are available about a large number of subjects in the world, not merely one. And on the basis of those data, a question is raised about the nature of all the data of the universe, and you are asked to answer the question as to what must necessarily be true of all the data. Not probably true, but necessarily true. Or else, if you can't find an answer in terms of rigorous necessity, you should be able to answer with the utmost probability regarding all the data. So, two kinds of answers are available at this stage in inquiry. The inquiry must be about all the possible data. That is what distinguishes philosophy from science. At present, science deals with only subject matters of one domain or the other. Philosophy deals with all the data of the entire universe. And secondly, it takes into account all the known data. And on the basis of the known data, an effort is made to imagine as to what must be the nature of all the other data which are not known, or secondly, what most probably must be the nature of the data which are not known. Now this process is what is called the logical process, as distinguished from the processes of imagination or poetry or of art or music or any other. This process of deriving necessary conclusions or most probable conclusions, this process is called a logical process. So you might say that the difference between poetry, music and art on the one hand and philosophy is that the imagination that is allowed in philosophy has to follow a logical process. In poetry, music and art, logical process is not necessary. We can deviate from logical process. There can be illogical process or logical with some license or supralogical. These are the methods of poetry, music and art. Illogical, logical with some licenses and supralogical. But in philosophy, the processes are supposed to be exclusively logical. Now the Life Divine is called a book of philosophy because it deals with all the known data of physics, chemistry, biology and all the whatever is known, all the data which are known and which are useful in deriving the knowledge about the unknown data. All this data are to be found in this book. That's the first reason why it is a philosophical book. But not merely that. On the basis of this data, a logical process has been employed to infer what must necessarily be the nature of all the data which are known or unknown, and a systematic, consistent picture of the whole is attempted to be presented. There is a rigor of logic. There are imaginations or inferences which are rigorously following a logical process. And the ultimate picture that emerges is that of the totality. So that you can be intellectually quite sure that even though sciences have not yet found out all the data in advance of the scientific discoveries, you are absolutely sure by this process as to what is the nature of the totality of reality. This is the special merit of philosophy, that even before science makes a full progress in arriving or at the knowledge of the totality, philosophy is like a foreigner and says that even with regard to whatever is available, on that very basis, I'll be able to tell you with certainty as to what must be the nature of the totality. Or if not absolute certainty, with the highest degree of probability, I'll tell you whatever is the ultimate total picture of the reality. This is the great work that is contained in the whole of the Life Divine, this whole book. Now you must have seen that in this whole argument, one word which I have used becomes central, and that is the word logic. You take out the word logic and all that I have said falls down. So the most important question is, what is the meaning of logic? Now this is a question which has been asked since thousands of years. What is logic? And even today the question is being asked. And while there are different answers to this question, there is a need to think on this question with a fresh mind. Normally it takes about several years to study what is logic. And I don't want that we should waste so many years in studying that subject. Within a short time, we may make an effort to get at the essence of the matter so that we can go ahead with our main inquiry. So I shall tell you very briefly what logic is. Let me take two examples to indicate to you what logic is. If I ask Tushar, what is the color of this statue here before me? He will say, it is black and gold. Part of it is golden, part of it is black. Then I ask him, is it both black and gold? Then he will clarify to me and said that where it is golden, it is not black. Where it is black, it is not golden. And then I ask him the question, why is it so? Why is it that what is golden is not black and what is black is not golden? Why is it so? Now, if he has not studied logic, he will simply tell me it is so. Then I ask him further question. It is all right, it is so. But is it necessarily so? That will be my further question. Is it necessarily so? In other words, the question would be, is it necessary that what is golden can never be black and what is black can never be golden? Is it necessarily so? Then he might scratch his head. It's a new question. So he might say, ultimately, that it is necessarily so. If you put gold on black, maybe some other color might come up. Or vice versa. Therefore, he will tell me, it is necessarily so, that what is black is black, what is gold. Having said this, Tushar may derive a conclusion that logically it is impossible for black to be gold and for gold to be black, logically. But you must see that he has actually said on the basis of experience. He has tried to make gold black or gold black, but he has failed to do so. Therefore, he concludes it is logically impossible. What is black is black, what is gold. And the two are opposite of each other. And now if he has become a good logician in the meantime, he will answer me a question. That gold and black are contradictory of each other. And two contradictions cannot be true of an object. An object cannot be such that it is what it is and it is opposite of it. If somebody says, I am riding a horse and I am not riding a horse, at the same time, in the same place, in the same state of consciousness, I may be riding in my dream while I am lying on my bed. That is possible. In the same state of consciousness, I am riding and not riding. It is not possible. The two are contradictory of each other. Therefore, logically, it is impossible that the same object can be having two contradictory predicates. This is what is normally called a basic principle of logic. Let me state it in a classical form. Logic is a science which tells you that when certain data are presented to you and you derive from those data a certain imaginative conclusion. And if your conclusion is true, then what has happened in your thinking by which your conclusion has been found to be true? I may show him a diamond and ask him a question. Is it also a pearl? I show him a diamond and I ask him, is it also a pearl? And by this time he has now learnt logic, so he says, diamond is a diamond and a pearl is a pearl. What is diamond cannot be a pearl, pearl cannot be a diamond. The two are contradictory of each other or contrary of each other. Therefore, if the object is a diamond, it cannot be a pearl. So you simply said, necessarily, it is not a pearl. That will be his answer. Necessarily, it will not be a pearl. He has applied what is called the law of contradiction. And this is the basic law of logic. The entire logic says nothing but this, basically. That when certain data are given to you, and you are required to derive some other data which are not known to you, then you can go from this to that, provided you follow and apply the law of contradiction. When you apply this law of contradiction, then you can be sure that your conclusion is not a pure fiction, is not fancy, is not fantasy. Even if it is imagination, it will be necessarily true. This law of contradiction is also called the law of identity. It is very easy to see why the law of contradiction is also called the law of identity. Law of identity says that a black cat is necessarily black. A black cat is necessarily black. Black is identical with black. Therefore, this statement must be true. There is no contradiction involved in the sentence. Therefore, the sentence must be true. Why? Because I am repeating an identity. A black cat is black. Therefore, this statement is true because it avoids all contradiction. You don't need to look at the cat again and verify whether it is really true or not. A black cat is black. If I tell you just like that, you will not need to go to black cat and find out that this statement is true or not. It is necessarily true. Why? Because no contradiction arises, or there is no possibility of arising any, of raising any contradiction. Whenever you state an identity, the possibility of contradiction ceases. Therefore, the law of identity is just the other way of stating the law of contradiction. Because in identities, there are no possibilities of contradictions, therefore the other side of the law of contradiction is the law of identity. What is free from contradiction is necessarily true. And what states identity is necessarily true. So both the statements are basically identical. Now there is also a third law of logic, which is another form of stating the law of identity or the law of contradiction. And what is that? It is called the law of excluded middle. Excluded middle. The law of excluded middle. When there are two contradictions regarding any object, one must be true, another must be false. The middle course is excluded. If there are two contradictions about any object, then you are sure that one of them must be true, one of them must be false. Therefore, it's called the law of excluded middle. So, law of contradiction supports law of excluded middle and vice versa. And law of causal action is basically the law of identity. You can apply all the three laws whenever you like, or you can say I am applying the one law, it is all the same thing. Logic has only one law, fundamentally. When you can show that the data which are before you and the data which are not known to you are basically identical in character, then you are certain that your conclusion is valid. Right? When the known data are shown to be identical with the data which are not known, but by some method if you can show that they are identical, then you can be sure that your conclusion must be true. This is called the rigor of logic and rigor of argument. Your argument must be such that from the known data, the conclusion that you are deriving is fundamentally identical. That is why you must have seen in mathematics, you have got identities. Most important part of mathematics consists of identities. The full chapter of identity is only this. Complete proof in mathematics is based upon identity. You show that this is exactly identical with this, then your proof is conclusive. That is why mathematics is also called logic, and logic is called mathematics. Mathematics also is the science of identities. Logic tells you that all reasonings are valid when you can show identities. Now, so far, everything seems to be quite simple. So far. Now we come to a little more complex statement. I am showing you all this because these chapters 9, 10, 11, 12 are great examples of the presentation of data which are known and presentation of that which is not known, and they are presented in such a way that the conclusions seem to be necessarily true or most probably true. Because the structure of the argument is of this nature, when you read these chapters, you will find how rigorously the entire statement is made, so that when you read them, at the end, your mind must be able to say, that is it, necessarily true. Or there can be no other conclusion than this. So that intellectually, in your mind, no doubt remains. So this is the condition. But to be able to understand this whole process, I have to introduce a further complexity. First, about the data. As I said, there can be no philosophy if there are no data. There must be some data before a philosophical study can begin. Secondly, we must strive to give as many data as possible, whatever is available. The larger the data that you have in your command, the greater will be the authenticity and certainty of your conclusions in regard to the data which are still not known. Now, what are the data that show up with the presence in these four chapters? Evidently, there are data which are available in physics, chemistry, biology, psychology. But more than that, Sri Aurobindo also brings in the data which are available to human consciousness when it practices yoga. And bring Gaur Gita also into the picture. But because the present mankind does not easily admit these data of yoga, Sri Aurobindo, while admitting those data and presenting those data, shows his cognizance of the problem for the present humanity. And therefore, in the argument, there are three aspects. While he admits the data from yoga, he shows that the present data without the yogic experiences are such and such. There are some other data which are available from yoga, and you may have hesitation in accepting them, but he shows why you should not have hesitation. There is an argument such that you are able to bridge yourself from the data which are available and which humanity access more easily to the data which are available but not easily acceptable to the modern humanity. This is the first task of the whole structure of his argument. Secondly, he shows that if you do not accept this data from yoga, then it will be impossible for you to arrive at any certain conclusion. And if you so prefer, you remain in this realm of uncertainty. But if you admit this data, then your conclusions will be certain. And both the possibilities are clearly mentioned. And thirdly, in deriving the conclusions, there is a strict rigor in which conclusions are shown to be necessarily implied or most probably implied. You will notice when you read these four chapters, you will find actually this is true of the whole book. But in these four chapters particularly, you will find this illustrated most conspicuously. I did not speak of all this while dealing with the chapter on triple transformation and the ascent to the supermind because those two chapters particularly are related to the statement of yogic data. There the data available in the modern science are not so relevant. But here, they are very relevant. Therefore, the data available from modern science and the data available from yoga are both presented, but presented in a particular neat form, so woven together that every strand of the argument is clear, and the alternative conclusions are clear, and when all the data which are presented, then the conclusions derived seem to be necessarily true or most probably true. In doing this, the law of identity, the law of contradiction, the law of accident middle, you will see are rigorously followed. Now, many people believe that logic consists of nothing but these three laws, study of these three laws. But all logicians do not agree with that view. For a long time in the history of thought, there was a view that logic consists only of the study of these three laws, law of identity, law of contradiction, the law of accident middle, which are actually one law. Look at it from three different points of view. But there was a great logician and a great mathematician and a great metaphysician in modern times called Leibniz. He challenged the view that there are only three laws of logic. He introduced a first law in logic. What is that first law? He called it the law of sufficient reason. Now let us again go to back to an example to understand this first law. When Tushar was a very young boy, he asked his mother a question, "Why is it raining?" And she said something of the kind. She said, "It rains sometimes." So he said, "But why must it rain? And why must it rain sometimes and why not all the time?" This is the question. So she said, "Look, before rain comes, there must be clouds in the sky. When there are clouds, it rains." And Tushar was for some time satisfied. You know, logic is also supposed to be a science which tells you by what reasoning human mind can be satisfied. What is that kind of reasoning which, when given, satisfies the human mind? The human mind says, "All right, now I'm satisfied." So here you answer Tushar saying, "When there is cloud, it rains." Then he went out of the room and saw a cloud. It was not raining. So he came back and said, "There is cloud, it's not raining." So his mother was obliged to say that it is not that whenever there is a cloud, there must necessarily rain. Now you see here in the reasoning, in previous examples, when it was gold, it must not necessarily be black. When it was black, it was not necessarily gold. But now you are asking, you are saying that when there is a cloud, it does not necessarily follow that it must rain. The first answer was all right. Why does it rain? Because there is cloud. But when there is cloud, now here was an example, it was not raining. So Tushar has an upper point now. And he says, that there is cloud, it's not raining. So you are answering that it is not a necessary law that whenever there is cloud, it must rain. Then here's a further question. Why is it that does not necessarily follow? If rain is always dependent upon the cloud, then why is it that when there is a cloud, it does not necessarily follow that there must be the rain? For a rain, cloud is a necessity. But for the cloud, rain is not necessary. Based upon this fact, Leibniz said that the world is not a world merely of necessities. If this world were ruled only by law of identity, only by the law of contradiction, only by the law of excess middle, then relationship of necessity would be reciprocal. But he said it is not so. The consequence depends upon antecedents. But antecedent does not necessarily imply a consequence. Therefore, he said this world does not operate only on the law of necessity. There are certain things which are necessary. But everything in the world is not necessary. But now, how will you explain to the child? You have first said that it rains because there was cloud. Now he has an example where there is a cloud, but there is no rain. How will the child be explained? So you will tell the child that, look, apart from the cloud, something else also must exist before the rain comes. Merely cloud does not mean rain. Something else also must happen. If that something else also happens, then rain will come. Father decides in the home what will be the arrangements of income and expenditure. The child wants to buy a thing, and child asks the mother, I want to buy this. And the mother says, when the money will come, I'll buy for you. Money comes and you buy for the child. Therefore, child thinks that whenever money comes, things can be bought. A relationship is established between money and buying. Next time he wants to buy, there is money also, and the mother says, no, I won't buy this. So child is puzzled. And the child asks the mother, why? Then the mother says that father has decided that we have to buy only a few things and not what you want. You get the permission of your father, you'll get it. Now, father has made a rule that in this house, this thing will not be bought. The child goes to the father, and the father says, I don't want it. In my house, this will not be allowed. Then the child argues and argues and argues. And then he says, all right, have it. Now the child concludes that apart from money, something else is needed for getting the thing that he wants to buy. What is something else? It is the father's will. Now, is father's will something which is rigid or is it flexible? In his experience, he found it is flexible. If you argue and argue and argue, the father will say, all right, have it. Now, next time when the child wants to buy something, the mother says, no, it can't be bought. Money is there, but it can't be bought. And child will understand. He'll be satisfied that mother is not able to buy because the father must have put some restriction on it. So he tries a previous example, going to the father and persuading him to buy it, and ultimately happening it again. So he derives a conclusion, a logical, a law of logic. Money is not the cause of buying. If it is a cause, it is necessary. If a seed is a cause of a tree, then the seed must produce the tree. Therefore, his conclusion is that the money is not the cause of buying. Apart from money, there must be a permission of the father. And permission of the father is simply a free will of the father. Simply he has to take a decision, yes or no, and immediately the money will trigger and the thing will be bought. And father's will is free. Sometimes he persuades the father, sometimes he cannot persuade the father. And father's will is free. Now from this he derives the following law. A thing is possible depending upon another thing. Buying of X is possible if money is present. So this X is a possibility if money is present. But money by itself is not sufficient to produce the buying. It's a possibility but not a necessity. Now this possibility is produced from this object called money. If above that there is a will of the father which is free, is exercised, then there is a pressure on this and the thing will be bought. So relationship between money and the object to be bought is not that of a cause and effect. What is the relationship? Not cause and effect. Cause and effect is a relationship in which cause necessarily produces an effect. The relationship is that of what is called reason. Money is a reason for buying a thing, but not the cause of it. Why is it a reason? Reason is opposed to impossibility, improbability. When something is possible, then that on which the possibility exists is called reason as opposed to improbability or impossibility. But that reason triggers of the result only if a free will is exercised. Now that free will exercise of it is called sufficient. Not only the reason should be present, but there should be sufficiency applied to that reason. The decision of the father is a sufficiency imposed upon the reason which produces the result. Therefore, Leibniz called this law the law of sufficient reason. That the world consists of two kinds of events, according to Leibniz. Events which are necessarily caused by causes, and events which are only possible depending upon reasons, which when they become sufficient, then they produce the concerned events. Now this is a great revolution in the thought of the world when Leibniz introduced this fourth law. And he proved that this is true in this world. We gave the example of rain. Even if the cloud is present, it does not necessarily follow that there must be rain. There must be some other thing on the basis of which it becomes sufficient so as to produce a consequence. Now this law is also found to be present in the exposition that Sri Aurobindo has made. The law of sufficient reason is also applied. There is a further point in the structure of the argument. We argued in the beginning that diamond is a diamond and a pearl is a pearl. And we say it is necessarily true. Now, why is it necessarily true? Because in experience we'll find that where there is gold, you can't put black on it. The two are contradictory of each other. Therefore, we say it is necessarily true that gold is not black and black is not gold. Diamond and pearl are opposite of each other. The same object cannot be both. It is a law, we say it is necessarily true, that two motor cars cannot run on the same ground. It's a fact. On the same ground, same inch of a ground, two motor cars cannot move. It's necessarily so. Now all this is true as far as the physical world is concerned. The question is it true also where physical reality is not in question? In the human mind, two ideas or five ideas or 10 ideas can stand exactly at the same time. Two motor cars cannot move on the same ground. That is physically true. But in the mind plane, that is not true. 10 ideas can run at the same time on the same terrain in the mind, in the mental terrain. So what is necessarily true in the physical plane is not necessarily true at the higher plane. Therefore, while you apply the laws of logic you must be very careful as to on what plane you are applying a particular law. Very often this is missed, and many debates in the arguments arise because this fundamental point is missed. There are lots of controversies in the world because in the thought clarity is so missing that while arguing on one plane, we also argue as if it is true also on the other plane. It is true that when the train is moving, it is not stationary. It's very obvious. If a train is stationary, it is not moving. Therefore, you can say that what is stationary is not moving. What is moving is not stationary, necessarily so. If I can show to a child, look, this train is stationary, then I can tell the child, look, it is not moving. Even if you are seeing it to be moving, sometimes it does seem to be so. Isn't it? When you are in a moving train and the other train is stationary, you think that that train is also moving. But you can prove that if it is stationary, it cannot move. Therefore, it is not moving, necessarily so. But it is a fact that psychologically, you can be at once very quiet and very dynamic. At once. On the contrary, the more quiet you are, the greater is the force of your dynamism. We always say to the archer, remain absolutely motionless. And the greater the motionlessness of the archer, the greater is the force with which he can release his arrow and strike the target. So you find that it is only when motion arises from motionlessness that the motion is the most effective. So there must be a simultaneity of motionlessness and motion. Therefore, if you argue that because it is motionless, therefore it cannot be a motion, it is true only of the physical plane. It is not true of the higher planes. Therefore, the logic which is true of the physical plane is not true of the logic of the higher plane. Logic is always a statement of the relationships which are found in the world of experience. When you find these relationships to be invariable, you say they are necessary relationships. Uncle cannot exist without a nephew. Nephew cannot exist without an uncle. These are necessary relationships. But all relationships are not necessary relationships. There are probable relationships. What is north is not necessarily north. What is north is not necessarily north. North is north necessarily only from the point of the south. North is north necessarily only from the point of the south. But from the point of the east, is no more north. Therefore, relationships change when you change your position of asking the question. Therefore, to say that everything in the world is necessarily so is not true. Therefore, a logical argument when you demand only necessary consequences itself is not logical. From a given point of view, if you can show that from this point of view, this is so, and it need not be necessarily so from another point of view, if you can show this, then this also can be called logical. If you can show that two contradictory things which are impossible to exist together on the physical plane, but which can coexist on the higher plane, there is nothing illogicality about it. We have only to find out whether it actually obtains or not. Therefore, merely applying what is called the law of contradiction, and therefore throwing out the argument, is not itself logical. If somebody says that diamond is a pearl and a pearl is a diamond, this statement can be quite true at the level of matter. At the level of diamond and the level of the pearl, it is true that the two cannot be together. But both of them are basically manifestations of material energy. So material energy is both a diamond and a pearl, basically. Therefore, to say that material energy is at once diamond and pearl, this is a true statement. Now, this kind of subtlety of the argument is also to be observed in these four chapters. So when you examine the whole structure of the argument in these four chapters, you will find, and this is the conclusion I am now deriving, that there are data presented. These data consist of two domains, of physical sciences and the data obtained from the yogic sciences. With the full cognizance that the modern humanity is reluctant to accept the data from the yogic science. So these four chapters present data obtained from physical sciences and the data obtained from the yogic sciences. With the full cognizance that the modern humanity is reluctant to admit the data from yogic sciences. Therefore, in the structure of the argument, whenever Sri Aurobindo wants to present the data from yogic sciences, he shows how the modern humanity will be benefited rightly if those data are admitted, yogic of the yogic sciences, and how the modern humanity should necessarily admit those phenomena in order to be impartial, in order to be as comprehensive as possible. And if this is not done, how you are left with questions which you cannot answer. There is nothing wrong about remaining uncertain about certain things. But if by the help of certain other data, if your answers can be more definitive, then what is the harm in admitting those phenomena by means of which you can be more certain than before? Then, on the basis of this data, conclusions are derived with regard to those where the data are not immediately available or not immediately available to the intellectual domain, although available in the yogic plane. And even when they are available in the yogic plane, how they can be intellectually admitted in the intellectual level. And then how the conclusions which are derived are necessarily true or most probably true and which can be seen by the application of the law of identity, law of contradiction, law of external middle, the law of sufficient reason, and even by admitting that the laws which are applicable at the physical plane may not be applicable at the higher plane, and where other laws will be applicable, finding out those laws and showing that on the basis of those laws, certain conclusions can be derived. This is the full structure of the argument that you find throughout the whole life divine. But these four chapters particularly give a conspicuous example of this structure of the argument. Now, so far I have spoken only of the structure of the argument. I have not spoken of the substance of the argument. But I want to explain the structure first, because what is so important in this philosophy is a structure by which you really establish your position. Structurally, your building up, your edifice must be perfect. And this is one great perfection that you find in these four chapters or in the whole of the life divine. The structure of the whole argument in the whole of the life divine is perfect from this point of view. Whatever I have told you, apply these propositions throughout the whole book and you will find that at every step, this is the structure of the argument. And it is perfectly, rigorously followed. Now is the question of the substance of the argument. Now this substance is a very vast subject. And while it will take us 3-4 sessions of this kind, I will just mention only two small things, just to sum up the substance of the argument. Sri Aurobindo says, in the 8th chapter, not in the 9th chapter, because the 9th chapter is a sequel to 8th chapter. In the 8th chapter, Sri Aurobindo has mentioned two things. We see always with two eyes. The eye of the idea and the eye of the fact. It is only when what is seen with the eye of the idea is corroborated by the eye of the fact that there is a full satisfaction in our sight. Somebody tells you that Bombay is full of skyscrapers. It's an idea. It is only when you go to Bombay and see with your eyes as a matter of fact that you are now convinced. The full conviction comes. Now, taking the clue from this, Sri Aurobindo says that God is an idea. And however that idea may be presented to you, may seem very great, wonderful, perfect, you will never be satisfied unless you can say or unless you can see with your own eyes God. So first of all, Sri Aurobindo says that God means such and such idea. In other words, Sri Aurobindo in these four chapters describes the idea of God. And then he says that this idea of God can also be seen to be experiential reality, a reality which you can experience. You can see God corresponding to the idea that is presented so that you have full satisfaction. Secondly, Sri Aurobindo says in the 8th chapter that this idea, this God, when experienced, is experienced as Satchidananda, that which exists, that which is conscious, and that which is full of delight. He says, such was the experience of the Vedic and the Upanishadic rishis. It was seen by them as such. Now, what is the meaning of existence? What is the meaning of consciousness? What is the meaning of delight? And how this concept, which is derived from the experience of Satchidananda, can explain the universe, that if God is such and such, world must be such and such. If world is such and such, God must be such and such. This is the substance of the argument of these four chapters. In other words, the entire life divine has one message, namely, that human life can become divine life. The human life can be lived in God. And the human life which you see today, full of troubles, can be transformed and can become divine. What does it mean? So first of all, there is a need to say what is divine and what is human. What is life and what is divine? So there is a need to give a total picture of human life and a total picture of divine. Now normally the divine is not a data of our ordinary experience. In our ordinary experience we only see matter, life and mind. Therefore, the divine is a matter to be inferred, to be imagined. But to be imagined by the process which you have described earlier. Can we show intellectually that God exists? In fact, this is one of the most important questions which is being asked by all human beings who pass an intellectual process. At one time or the other, human beings do ask a question. Can you be certain that God exists? Can you intellectually prove that God exists? And if you can prove that God exists, can you explain this miserable world? If God really exists, can the world be like what it is? Can you derive this world from God? If God is Satchidananda and the world is full of misery and death, how can you derive this from there? So either world exists but God does not exist, or if God exists, the world does not exist. But the world exists. Therefore, God must not be existing. If God does not exist, then the divine life is an impossibility. But if the whole argument of the book is that divine life is not only a possibility but inevitability, then it is necessary to show to the reader that God is not a contradiction of the world and the world is not a contradiction of God. And there are some missing points because of which this contradiction appears to be so. What are those missing points? How has these missing points come about? And what is the nature of God? Because even about God there are many concepts. So Sri Aurobindo says that if you define God properly, both from the point of view of the idea and from the point of the fact, whatever concept of God you derive must be idealistically perfect, sound, clear, without confusion, and it must correspond to the fact of experience of God. So let us first of all paint the picture of God, then let us draw the picture of the world accurately, without exaggeration. And then try to see how the two stand together in relationship. If you can then show that the present world as it is can be derived from God, and because the present world is what it is, and because God is what God is, therefore this world can be transformed into divine life, divine world. If this can be shown very neatly and clearly, then only our case is established. This fundamental work is the task of these four chapters. This is the substance of these four chapters. Does God exist? Can he be proved both from the point of view of idea and from the point of view of fact? What is the correct concept of God from both these points of view? What is the accurate picture of the world And can this world be derived from God? And from that derivation, can we further derive that this world can be transformed into divine life? This is the basic argument of these four chapters. So next time we shall take up these arguments, the substance of the arguments. All right.